Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and today it's about the most popular, longest-running rock and roll magazine of all time, talking about Rolling Stone. And we're here with senior editor Patrick Doyle. Rolling Stone celebrated their 50th anniversary last year. We're recently bought by a new owner, but the great rock and roll features, interviews, and covers will continue. I've been subscribing for about 15 years. Love Rolling Stone. Patrick's got plenty of stories about covering some of rock's biggest icons, like the Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, Paul McCartney. He spent a week with Kid Rock as Kid Rock shot a bunch of pigs. Spent another week with Ed Sheeran, played basketball with Mumford & Sons, sat down with Kings of Leon. Patrick's stories are endless, and you hear what it takes to get a story, break a story, and not kill a relationship in the process. And of course, he's got a wish list a mile long, and you hear a few legendary names that he hopes to have a chance to interview in the future. He's talking about his boss, Jan Wenner, the man who founded Rolling Stone magazine, and what Patrick learned from Jan and is still learning from Jan. We got rock and roll stories coming up with Patrick Doyle, senior editor of Rolling Stone magazine, on the cover of the Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone! Some good rock and roll by Dr. Hook right there. And some good rock and roll with Fozzy coming up as we get ready to kick off the European tour tomorrow night, July 26th at the Fezzen Festival in Hungary. Tonight, I'm going to go see Halloween, who's headlining the Fezzen Festival. We're on the main stage tomorrow night in Hungary. We've got a long show. And then 27th, it's a headlining show in Prague, Czech Republic at Futurum Rock Ballroom or something like that. 28th, Rock of Ages Festival in Sebron, Germany. 29th, another headlining show, Zurich, Switzerland at Werk 21. Fozzy's going to be rocking all night long in Zurich. 7:31 at the Rock Planet in Pinerello di Servia in Italy. August 1st in Slovenia. August 3rd, Wacken Festival in Wacken, Germany, returning to Wacken after so many years. On August 4th, another Fozzy headlining show in Berlin, Germany. August 6th and 7th in Bochum and Aschaffenburg, we are supporting Mr. Big. August 9th, Leyendas de Rock Festival in Alicante, Spain. August 11th, the Alcatraz Festival in Belgium. And August 12th, Bloodstock at Canton Park in Walton-on-Trent, Derbyshire, England. That's 9 countries, 6 festivals, 4 shows supporting Mr. Big, 3 headlining shows, and a partridge in a pear tree. Go to FozzyRock.com for all ticket information. And then we come back to the States for the start of the Judas Rising Tour on Friday, August 24th, in Atlanta, Georgia, at Smith's Old Bar with Adelita's Way, Stone Broken, and The Stir coming out with us in the States. The first week is the 26th in Huntsville, 29th in Clarksville. Take the last train to Clarksville. We got Birmingham on the 25th, August 31st, Little Rock. A lot of great shows coming up, so go to FozzyRock.com to check all ticket information and be a part of the VIP meet and greets. Legendary. We play a mini concert for you guys. We sign stuff. We take pictures with you. We hang out. Do not miss Fozzy in concert live or the VIP program. We're going to Australia in November. We'll start promoting those gigs soon. The VIP for Melbourne and Sydney already sold out 4 months in advance. All the other gigs still have VIPs available. You do not want to miss it. Go to FozzyRock.com and check it out. And stick with us right here. Patrick Doyle and 50 years of Rolling Stone magazine starting now.
We're here at the huge complex of Rolling Stone, very close to Jan Wenner's office, who is not here, but Patrick Doyle is. Now, you have been writing for Rolling Stone for how many years?
8 years.
8 years.
Yeah.
Okay. And a lot of people, like for me, being a musicologist and a writer as well, writing for Rolling Stone seems like it's a pretty damn cool dream gig.
Absolutely.
How did you end up getting this?
I got it when I was going to college at NYU, and I would just review concerts to get into them for free, basically. and then I majored in journalism at NYU, and then started writing about them for the Village Voice, doing interviews and stuff like that. And then I had to do an assignment, actually, where I had to interview somebody who had been through like a traumatic experience. So I interviewed actually a mother of who lost her son in 9/11, actually. And so I interviewed her for a class, and then she said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, music writing, journalism." And she said, "Oh, my son works at Rolling Stone." So she kind of hooked me up, because I've been trying to get into the door through Rolling Stone forever. So it just kind of was a weird thing that happened where
you have to submit some pieces to get in, or how does it work?
Yeah, I submitted it, and I remember it was just for an internship. So I've been here since I was interning, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I've been here. It was an assistant editor, and then associate editor, senior editor.
What's your official title?
It's a senior editor.
Senior editor.
Yeah. So it's been a fun time. I mean, you get to go out and have these, meet the people that you have grew up listening to, and grew up a huge Stones fan, playing guitar, to like talk to Keith Richards and all these people. It's
I got the Stones tattoo right there. Yeah.
Wow. Sticky Fingers. Is that your favorite?
That's my favorite. Yeah. Sticky Fingers. You?
Oh man. It always goes up and down, but I mean,
The Mick Taylor era for me.
Yeah.
All those albums could go. Although It's Only Rock and Roll But I Like It is okay. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about Let It Bleed. You're talking about Sticky Fingers. You're talking about, you know, Exile.
I like even like Dirty Work and like the weird.
Stones in the 80s.
Yeah. Because that's kind of a Keith album. Keith was in the driver's seat for that album. And Mick kind of just came in. So I love Keith's solo stuff. Mm-hmm. It's Expensive Winos and like that. So it kind of has that vibe to it.
So you said you're a big Stones fan. What was the first thing you ever got to do? Did you write something for the Stones? Did you meet the Stones?
Yeah. Well, they were putting out their Some Girls reissue, and I got assigned to go to talk to Mick and Keith. And it was actually this time when they hadn't been touring for about 5 years, and fans were wondering what was going on with them. And so I talked to Mick, and when you talk to Mick, it's usually pretty brief, and he just wants to kind of tell you what he wants to tell you, and then you can tell when it's wrapping up. He'll say,
"So you got 10 minutes with Mick?"
He'll call you, 15, 20 minutes, and then he's very friendly and gives you some great stuff, but not a lot. He doesn't like to give away a lot. But Keith, on the other hand, will just start talking. And so he called, and Mick his people call, and this is to say we're here with Mick Jagger.
Gotcha. So it's over the phone.
In this case it was on the phone. Since then I've done stuff in person with Keith, but with Mick they'll call you and then patch you through, but with Keith it's always just him, and it's actually always on time. Exactly on time, or early. And even in person, he's always on time, which you would think you'd be waiting up for hours or something.
That's old school professional conduct, though.
Yeah.
You know, you get there on time and you do your gig, right?
Yeah. And they will constantly say your name, which is also a professional old school thing, you know?
Great call. And look you in the eye. Yeah. Charmers.
Yes.
You know, guys who have been in the business for that long at that level, it's like they're such charmers.
Yes.
Because they've been trained to do that, right?
Yeah. If you're ever nervous about meeting those guys, there's never any reason to be nervous, because they know how to make it nice, you know? Bono or anything.
Sure. So you tell us, so Mick is very, very mechanical, and but Keith is more freeform.
Yes. And so, but at this point, they had not been together for a long time, and I'm just always into what's going on with them, and I want to know when they're going to tour next. And so I asked Keith when they were going to be getting back together, because the reason for this interview was not for future Stones plans. It was reissue. I asked Mick about it, and he just kind of said, "Oh, I don't know, you know."
Yeah.
But Keith said, "Well, I'm ready to go. I have songs written. I don't know. We have to celebrate our 50th anniversary, but I'm waiting for Mick Jagger to give me a call." And so that kind of became the story. And then I called Ronnie about it, and then he said, "Well, they've been going through some stuff right now after Mick's book, Keith's book."
Yeah.
Keith wrote a bunch of stuff about Mick. And
the one thing that I heard is Mick was very mad that Keith said he had a small penis.
Yeah, he wrote that, but I think I think that was probably the least he was angry about. It was just a lot about Mick's general character, and I think that stuff really probably got under Mick's skin,
right?
Because those guys have known each other since they were little kids, and to have somebody you really know that really knows you to really sum you up like that must hurt, you know?
Yeah.
So Keith went on and on about you know, the problems they've been having, and I forget exactly what he said, but Ronnie said that he thinks that they have a lot of work to do patching things up and everything. And then I called Bobby Keys before he died, and they talked. So then it became a story about, will the Stones get back together? And there was actually a lot of behind the scenes stuff of them trying to get the story crushed and everything.
Really?
And
they didn't want it about that.
Yeah. But once Keith started saying it, it wasn't like I made Keith say anything. Mm-hmm. He was the one who started. So once they made that news, it was like we had to write that. So that was the first thing I did on the Stones. I did the next thing was a Keith cover story, which was in he lives in Ridgefield, Connecticut, in a nice, you know, Norman Rockwell town. And we went to this restaurant, Luke's, that he goes to for lunch all the time. And
he grows grapefruits out there.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
I met him through Jimmy Fallon. The three of us had a conversation.
No way.
Just to kind of piggyback on what you said, to add to it, this was after the 50th anniversary concert that they did at the Barclays Center.
Yeah.
And I asked him about it because it's a long story, but I basically asked him, like, you know, it was such a great show and will you do more? And he said, I knew if I could get him to come on stage and play that he would want to do more. And I was right. He never said the name Mick.
Yeah.
He just said he. If I could get him to show up, that he would want to do more. And you can see there's a thought out of it, but he was still very proper with the him and he, yeah, you know, that sort of right. thing. But then he told me about his giant grapefruits that he grows out in Connecticut.
Right. Yeah. That's amazing. What else did you guys talk about?
Well, I talked to him because in that long story short, I did the Fallon show.
Yeah.
I know Jimmy. I was sitting in the office looking at who was coming up. I said, oh my gosh, Keith is coming up on Monday. He said, if you show up here at 5 p.m., I'll introduce you to him. So I did, and he did. And we hung out and talked. And I talked to him about at that pay-per-view they had done, I'm Going Down.
Yeah.
With Gary Clark Jr. Yeah. And John Mayer.
Yeah.
Everyone was doing these crazy solos, and then Keith just walked up there and hit one note, meow, and then bow, and just left. It was the coolest thing ever. And I asked him about that, and he said, well, everybody was playing so busy that I thought I would just pick one note and stick with it.
Yeah.
And I just had to make sure it was a good one, man. So just, you know, like you said, it's not hard to talk to Keith Richards.
Yeah.
You know, so it was very easy, free-flowing conversation, and it was a blast.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm saying. When you go meet him for lunch and you say that's not, it just seems like he's just a dude that likes to hang out.
Yeah. When I was doing the cover story, the thing that struck me was he has an assistant with him, and everywhere he goes, you know, those little airplane sized bottles of vodka, they a huge case of them would be wherever we would go, and they would make a fresh orange soda vodka for him every 15 minutes. No matter how much he had drank, a new fresh one would show up. Mm. And it was just a constant buzz. He kept going. And that started at like 2 p.m. when I saw him. It was the second time at like a recording studio when he was doing his solo album. And just smoke and vodka and like just...
just what you would expect to see with the Stones. You know what I mean?
And but that story, it was actually... it's a little intimidating. Like I went to the restaurant and we talked for a while, but that was like an hour. And in order to get a cover story amount of material, that's really not enough unless you're doing a Q&A format where you're just question answer. But
how much does it take for a cover story?
Sometimes as little as two hangouts, I would say.
Two hours?
A couple hours each. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I did an Ed Sheeran story, and that was like... that was about 2 weeks of total of time.
And why?
Like I went to London, and he said, and ended up staying at his house. It was just,
I read that one.
It was just
talking about how he was getting loaded or his friends or whatever it was. Yeah.
And he was just, I don't know. It just kind of, he was fun to hang out with, and he wanted to, I think that also part of that was that he would party a lot and then want to rein it back in and not, and fix what happened the night before. So it was a constant cycle of that. But with Keith, the last chance, I felt like I didn't have enough. I had been with him at the restaurant, and it was a great conversation. We were at the recording studio, And then we got into a car to go downtown to this promotional thing at the iHeartRadio thing, and people were chasing the car after him, and it just felt like a Beatlemania type thing, because he said this is just part of life, and he was kind of talking about that a bit, and then he disappeared into this green room, and his publicist had disappeared, so I didn't have to kind of go through her anymore. So I just kind of walked in and sat down, and it was just him and Jane Rose, who's has been his manager for.
She was in the room too with Fallon, yeah.
Yeah, she's all she's very cool. Everywhere, yeah. So I was like, I don't know, I don't want to overstep my bounds, because you like to give people space and everything, but in this case, I felt like this was my last chance. Then I ended up being there for like 3 hours with him, and he just was. It was when Trump had just kind of started to pick up steam, and he was talking about watching the rally and. How he felt like his set list was getting a little stale. And he said, I don't know, he's going to change the set list eventually. He's just his take on it wasn't an interview. It was just hearing him kind of riff on stuff.
It's interesting.
That was when I felt like I kind of understood him, because he was more laid back. He wasn't playing pirate characters.
But that's the thing too, though, Patrick, that I noticed like from doing this show. It's been 4 years for me now. And I love the concept of a long form interview, because I know what it's like to do. Okay, you got a radio tour. Okay, every 6 minutes, there's a new station.
Yeah.
You get nothing.
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes 10, 15, 20 minutes. My show is usually an hour.
Yeah.
But you start getting deep.
Yeah.
And for you talking about going with Ed Sheeran for 2 weeks or with Keith, like it took you a while to break down the Keith Richards, the rock star, to just being Keith Richards, the dude.
Yeah.
And that's where you get the brilliant stuff.
Exactly.
Right?
And that's why I like working here. I feel like this is one of the only places that can still do
I
that.
I agree.
And that's why it feels like such an honor to work with this place. Yeah.
You know, it seems to me too, like people know the Rolling Stone magazine is a big, even Rolling Stone online. I do a bunch of stuff. They call me all the time for different things. It's like, it's Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
When people agree to do the Rolling Stone interview, they know what you need. They know you want time from them. Is that pretty much the norm, or sometimes do you get granted an interview and the guy like says, I'll give you an hour, and you're like, I need more than this?
Yeah, you often need more. These days, a lot of people want the cover, because that's what gets picked up, you know, around the world, is the image of the cover.
Sure, of course.
And I guess it's always been that way, but a lot of times it's a negotiation, because we can't put everyone on the cover, so it's like, then we'll give you an inside feature. Oftentimes, there's like a story right now with an artist. I'm trying to, he wanted a cover, and then, so he said, no, we'll give you a feature. And they said no. And we said no, they said no. And anyway, so now it might be the rock lead, which is the front of the magazine, the news opener.
Yeah.
And that is a good place, because it's like,
it's the first thing you see.
First thing you see, but it doesn't take a lot of time. So I feel like that is the fallback plan for them, but it's getting in the mechanics. Sorry.
No, I understand. Just, no, I get it though. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
I see what you're saying. So tell me some other people that you interviewed. What I'm saying is, when you go and, like you said, Ed Sheeran, you guys become friends, Keith, you're hanging out. Is there some people that you've done where it's just kind of like, this guy isn't giving me anything. Mm-hmm. Doesn't he know what we're doing here?
Yeah.
Like, I had Mike Tyson on this show and he gave me nothing.
Yeah.
One word answers. And I'm like, you know, you're doing a podcast. You gotta give me something, dude.
Yeah. Well, I've had bad experiences. You can't, when those happen, you say like, they can't all be great. Like you've done, I don't know how many podcasts, but
once
has to
a
go
while.
Bad.
Yeah.
That's what you tell yourself after that. But Mumford and Sons was kind of a bad situation, because I was I was going to Massachusetts to go meet up with them, and it was. So anyway, I was on the way to the interview, and my boss forwarded me an Us Weekly email saying that Marcus Mumford was expecting a baby with his wife. So I said, oh, that's interesting. I mean, it's not what I'm going to write about really, but so we got there, and you have to kind of figure out what you're going to do with these people. And I don't like doing forced activities, some like bowling with somebody. And but this, they said, oh, he's out playing basketball. I guess it's something he naturally does before, so you're gonna play basketball with him. So sorry, it's a little weird to meet someone and just start playing basketball. So we were playing what's the game,
horse.
Yeah. And then, and I hadn't played since like third grade, and you're trying to remember how to play horse and think of the questions you're going to ask. And then, so then to make things a little more comfortable, I just said, you know, by the way, congratulations on, heard you, he said, about what? And then I said, I heard you're going to be a dad. And then he just turned stone faced and said, well, that's just gossip, isn't it? I said, oh, okay. I didn't really know. And then he walked away, and then his publicist said, you shouldn't have said that, you know.
Why?
Because I think he's trying to keep his private secrets, life private. Yeah. But I honestly just saw the email and thought it was an announcement. I didn't mm-hmm. know it was a secret thing. So the interview was called off after that. But I went down to Bonnaroo and spent time with them, and a week later, and they had warmed up a little bit, and he was a little more laid back. We never spoke about it after that.
Never mentioned it again.
Didn't even mention it when I saw him. And Kings of Leon was another weird experience because they're just so open about drugs and sex and everything. And the singer talked to me about taking too many pain pills and getting too drunk on a flight and on a yacht, and about how he did a jump off of a yacht and broke his leg or something. And so I wrote that. I mean, that became, of course, the beginning of the story. And they weren't happy with how they were portrayed. But I mean, it's,
you got to be careful what you say, though, as an entertainer, because anything you say is open game, unless you say this is off the record.
Have you trusted a journalist and then it turns out?
Yeah, what I find a lot of times is you'll get misquoted or slightly switched around. I know, like earlier this year when I have a band called, our band's Fozzy, and I said something about, like, you know, as long as it's me and this guy and this guy, it's okay. If the other guys weren't there, it wouldn't matter. And I never, my point was, this is the three guys that have done it from the start. Yeah. We've had guys come and go. And that's, you know, we would still continue on no matter what. Not saying demeaning the other guy, but the other dude called me. And he's like, is this, I don't mean anything to you. I was like, that's not what I said, dude. Mm. And that causes problems. But it was a better clickbait thing to basically say, Jericho says the other band members don't mean shit. It's all about him. You know, the sensationalistic.
Yeah.
You find that.
Yeah. And when you're starting out, as your instinct is to do more of, you're kind of trying to learn how to write and make a compelling story. So sometimes somebody will say something to you and you're like, oh, that's news. I gotta get that up on the website, like, soon. And then you do that before the thing that they got on the phone to talk to you about. And then you quickly learn that it's not a good way to have long lasting relationships.
Yes. You have to have trust with those guys.
Yeah.
Especially when you're talking about Keith or you mentioned Bono. I mean, these guys have been around for years. They probably don't trust anybody.
Yeah.
So to gain their trust probably takes a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
It does, yeah.
Tell us some of the other great interviews that you've had. Oh, or interesting ones that you've had.
Kid Rock was a good one.
I think this is the one that I read.
Explained, really?
I think.
Well, this was sort of when he'd gone country, but this was before the Senate run, or the toying with the idea of running for Senate and becoming such a right-wing guy. But so it was a little, people didn't really know where he stood, but this was sort of his coming out in that world. He was living in Alabama. I went down to, it was like 30 miles outside of Montgomery, Alabama. He had a trailer, a $19,000 trailer that he was living in. But he said, you know, he has the jet there too.
The yin and yang.
Yeah. So I woke up that morning at the hotel, and I had texts from him starting at like 5:30, like, you know, just come over whenever, don't wait till lunch. I have a surprise for you. And I didn't know what the surprise was. So I drove, and it was literally 10 miles with nothing until you got to his house. And he kept talking about the surprise that he made me a sandwich. And then we got on his ATV and went into the woods. And there were three pigs that he had caught in a cage. And he said he had been complaining about his land getting torn up by pigs,
like wild pigs.
Yeah, wild, and which he kept saying are like a nuisance down there. It's like it's
invasive species or something. Yeah.
So he shot all of them in front of me, and he had his girlfriend there, and she shot one of them, and he had me film the whole thing, which he played for party that he had that night, and everyone was, you know, clapping and freaking out. And so he wanted that to be written about, but it caused a big uproar, you know, animal rights and everything after that. And it was just,
why would he want to show you this?
I think his fans are okay with that.
Rednecky type.
Yeah, he has a crew. He said to me, my fans, my bread and butter are like age 45 to 55, extra, extra large, big girls. he doesn't make any bones about it. So he has a cruise, and he was showing videos from the cruise of those fans, you know, showing me who they were and trying to just get me familiar with his world.
I've known him for a few years, and we were touring in Australia together, not on the same bill, but at the same time, we happened to be in the same hotel.
Yeah.
And I was hanging out with him, and I remember he's like, yeah, I don't really like Australia too much. And he goes, I can sell out Louisville. Why do I want to go to Australia?
Right.
And that's his point. Like, he can sell out everywhere in America. Why do I need to go overseas? He was opening for Bon Jovi.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, I don't need this $100,000 that Bon Jovi's playing, but my girlfriend wanted to go to Australia. So I took him. I'm like, yeah, poor guy with your $100,000 that Bon Jovi gave you to play a 45-minute set in the stadium.
Yeah. He loves talking about his jet. You know, he was, I heard him on Howard Stern, and he was still talking about it, you know, that he will get rid of his Malibu mansion, but he needs to keep the jet because he, like, you know, he met his girlfriend, and he said, can I take you to dinner? She was a waitress, and this was in Detroit. And she said, well, where are we going to go? And he said, Chicago. So he likes to just with his buddies, go somewhere on one night and come back the same night. But that experience lasted from then until 6 a.m. the next morning, nonstop. And that, every time I was with him, that's what it was like. And he's a really nice guy.
So, good dude.
So it's a little bit of a conflict because he does that kind of fucked up stuff, shooting the pigs and saying, you know, just stuff you don't agree with. But at the same time, he does take care of his family and take care of a lot of the charities around his town. So he's kind of a complex guy. And that was kind of interesting to write about, but it was kind of a struggle to write that story. Cause I didn't like a lot of the stuff he said or his politics or things he did and shooting pigs. But I just wrote it from the very, for the text that he was sending all the way through that 6 a.m. the next morning. And, it didn't even include a lot of editorialism, just kind of.
But isn't happened. That your job as a journalist, though, is to be kind of neutral and just report? Like, I think Rolling Stone came up with the tagline is the facts. What does it say?
All the facts fit to print.
Print.
But a lot of times it's tough because you'll be with a pop star and they don't know how to put a sentence together sometimes. So you have to put it in perspective a lot more. If somebody, if they're colorful, like Kid Rock, people are going to want to be interested to read.
He knows how to do an interview.
Yeah. And he's great quote, but a lot of the times, sometimes you'll write a whole feature and realize you didn't use a lot of quotes at all. Like maybe just a six or something, because it's hard to get insightful stuff from like a 19-year-old sometimes, you know?
Right. Somebody who doesn't have a lot of experience, but is super popular.
Yeah.
And especially in this day and age, you see a lot of that, of the flash in the pans, here today, gone later today.
Yeah.
And not as much of the longevity of the stars, you know?
Yeah. Do you like any of the current pop stuff at all?
Well, the thing is, I drive my kids to school and we have to listen to Hits 1, which is the serious, you know? So I hear the same 10 songs. And I know what's going on. I think Bruno Mars is amazing.
Yeah.
He's probably my favorite. I mean Taylor Swift is great.
Her album is really good.
Yeah, she's great. New album, you know, really, she's great because she's done a very smart thing and kind of went outside of the box of what she was known for. She's very diverse.
Yeah.
And that's a smart thing to do, to get that kind of, it's not just a country girl, but she can do pop and she can do 80s synth and she can do a cheerleader type tune or whatever it may be. It's a smart move. And have you had any experiences with her? Because she's very smart for such a young girl.
Yeah. A few. I got into her around the Speak Now era. Mm-hmm. It's 2010.
Yeah.
And I was assigned to write about her when she was playing at the JetBlue Terminal 5, you know, as a promotional thing. And she was flying her fans to LA and they were all going to interview her this was like early on in her
career.
She was still an arena act, but she was willing to do stuff like, now she does zero interviews whatsoever.
Interesting. Cause she didn't have to.
Yeah. It's Beyonce does that. Once you get to a certain level,
same thing. It's not the same. Remember Iron Maiden?
Yeah.
Try and get an interview with Iron Maiden. They don't do them. They don't need them.
No.
You know, like their managers, we sell out either way. Why waste time? You know?
Yeah. And you can only hurt yourself at a certain point.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's out to get Taylor Swift.
Yes.
You there's nothing she could say that people will not take and twist. Mm-hmm. And so, I met her on that tour. Then I did an interview with her on the Red tour backstage and at the MetLife Stadium. And she was just really smart, but at the same time, you know, very good at evading questions. I remember just asking her, like, you try to find out what a person does that day. You try to, if you have a very little time with somebody, a good thing to do is to ask them, like, hey, what have you done today? So you can kind of say this, you know, they're doing this after doing this, this, and this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that way people get, and it looks kind of like you've spent a little bit more time, you know, mm-hmm. with them. So, but she, I said, well, what did you eat at catering? And I just was curious what she picks out, but she didn't want to answer that.
Yeah.
So, but she can see two steps ahead of whatever you're doing.
That, like I said, I've done, I don't know how many interviews, 10,000 interviews, and you can tell right away.
When someone doesn't want to answer something.
Well, yeah. Or, I mean, for me, interviewing me, and there's certain, someone will say something, it pisses me off.
Yeah.
Maybe even indirectly, you really shut down.
Yeah.
And there's other interviews that I'll talk all day because it's fun.
Yeah.
But there's ones I got to get out of here.
Yeah.
You know, if someone ever asked me, so if it's wrestling, so how'd you get into wrestling? Or how'd you start with Fozzy? It's like, oh my gosh, dude.
Yeah.
After 17 years or 27 years, that's what you're opening with?
Yeah.
What kind of an answer do you want?
Yeah.
So you have to be careful as a journalist asking. Like you said, if you ask Taylor, what do you have to eat? She could be thinking, what does this guy care what I've had to eat?
Yeah.
And she's done.
Yeah.
Right? It's hard. Like you said, the Mumford & Sons guy, you were done.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he was done. And then I saw her on the 1989 tour after 2 years later, and she came up and said, oh, we were in the room where the team gets the massages. I remember we were doing the interview there. She's just very smart and remembers everyone by their name and knows their kids' names. And, you know, she's the radio people. I mean, she's just very, I don't think it's insincere. I think she's just affable person, but she's very good at it. But yeah, she's
tell me about some others. Like you mentioned, like it's interesting because you talk about, and I want to talk about Young Winner as well, but
yeah.
Rolling Stone is very much a Springsteen friendly, U2 friendly.
Yeah.
Have you had experience with Metallica friendly?
Yeah.
Do you get sent out on those type of things as well? Have you had conversations with those dudes?
Yeah. Let's see. Well, I mean, U2, I've talked to Bono before. I mean, the McCartney, that the Hall of Fame, that was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame when Ringo was inducted.
Yeah, I was there
that year.
I was there.
So yeah, McCartney inducted Ringo, which was really cool to see them playing together.
It was great.
And, yeah. And afterwards, I always wanted to talk to Paul McCartney, and he was just, and his publicist had shut me down and said, no, he's not doing any interviews. But then he was just standing on stage and people were crowding around him like, you know, the Beatles, you know, and so I just kind of went up and he just sort of just turned. It was just all happened the right way. And then I said, I'm here with Rolling Stone. Can I ask you some questions? We ended up doing a few, several minutes and
just on the fly. He said, okay.
He said, okay. And then he did it. And
it takes a lot of balls.
Those are the toughest ones. The Hall of Fame is just interesting because you're trying to catch people on the fly. And, like Tom Waits is another one. He was inducting Neil Young, or they played together, I remember, but his publicist said no to interview, and then he was just standing there, and then some of the editors, this is when I had just started, and they said, you know, we'll really, they were kind of busting my balls a little bit. They said, you know, if you get an interview with Tom Waits, that would be great for your career. So I went up to him, and then I said, I work at Rolling Stone, a couple of the editors talking to me about really wanting to, you know, get an interview with you, and would you answer just a question about what it means to be here? And then he just said, oh yeah, okay, no. And then his wife said, you gotta go. And so you just have to check
but,
your
but
ego.
Paul did
Paul,
agree.
Yeah, Paul did. And actually Brian Hyatt was at backstage at Live 8 and in London, and he I think,
who's Brian Hyatt?
He's a senior writer here.
Gotcha.
And he's written like 55 cover stories. I think he has the record, but he went up to Roger Daltrey and asked him on the fly for an interview, and Daltrey said fuck off. And then he went up to McCartney, and McCartney just talked to him. So I like that Paul just you know, he's not too jaded or anything. He's,
I always get the sense that I've never had the dude talk about bucket list. I've never had the pleasure. Actually, I met him at that Rock and Roll.
Really? Were you on stage there when he was meeting
people? I was not
people?
On stage. I was in the crowd.
Yeah.
Going
it was
crazy.
After when people were just milling around.
Yeah. No, I had a couple of cool experiences that I'll tell you after because it's been well documented on this show. But I get the sense that Paul's, after all these years, is still just a dude.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, just a guy that just likes to, he's got a cool job and he feels pretty cool. I don't ever get the sense of an asshole from him. And maybe that's just years of being trained that way, but I don't think so. I don't think there's a gag there, you know?
The only thing he seems hung up on is the songwriting, the credit, feeling like he might not get as much credit as John Lennon.
It's all Lennon and McCartney.
Yeah. Like, remember he asked to switch some of the song titles from McCartney Lennon.
Yeah.
And then we were doing an interview. I assigned a guy here, Corey, to talk to him. And Corey said something very offhand, like about for the benefit of Mr. Kite, because Paul had started playing that on his latest tour. And he asked about why he is playing that, because it's, you know, primarily thought of as a John song. And so Paul, that set Paul off. He just said, I was there when he wrote that song. I was part of that process. Everyone says it's a John Lennon song. It's not a John Lennon song. That's, I think, if you want to push his buttons, that's
go there.
Yeah.
After all these years, right? But but you get that too. Like you mentioned Mick and Keith.
Yeah.
And Paul and John. Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. There's still a rivalry.
Yeah.
Joe Perry and Steve Tyler. The guys, the two alpha males in the band, after all these years, sometimes are still very sensitive when it comes to stuff like that.
Yeah. It's weird. I think that it's like a wife. Keith calls Mick his wife. And it really is like a jealous romantic relationship.
Right.
You're
trying
to get that guy's attention and
better than him
and
better than
approval
him,
and you want to be better than that person and it's very complicated.
So which cover stories do you have? You mentioned that the one dude at 55. How many do you have?
I have like seven, but I have like 25 features. But I'm an editor these days.
Sure. You don't write as much then?
I edit, I assign stuff and then edit them. And I do write, but
do you save the good ones for yourself?
You have to be aware of that. Like you have to throw people bones. Dude. If you really want to do like a Springsteen or something, and then when he's available, I know that I can't be the guy who just it's the cake and eats it too. And plus, like Andy and people are better Springsteen fanatics than me. But
so you kind of stick in your wheelhouse. The bands, like if it's a Stones thing, you know more about the Stones. So you're the best guy for the job.
Yeah, it's. I think they just people know their territory here, and it's not
that makes sense.
Like you're not hired as like a hip hop guy or a pop guy. It's just sort of people figure it out about you over the
years. Which 70s you said? Sheeran was one. Kid Rock was one. Keith.
Keith and Sam Smith, and then 5 Seconds of Summer. That's boy band. Pop punk boy band that sort of were the rockier One Direction at the time, and that was a crazy experience because that was like a week long experience, and they had never really spent a lot of time with the journalists. They were 19 years old and very green, and said a lot of things they shouldn't have said. And talked about, you know, the early days on the road, hooking up with their fans. And a lot of the fans saw that as them talking about having sex with their fans as like taking advantage of their fans. And it turned into a big deal. And that they haven't really recovered.
I haven't heard anything about them in a while.
I think they went underground for a while.
Does that heat come back on you then? Are you to blame?
I was a little torn about that because you're with them for a week, and we were just in a trailer at the American Music Awards, and the singer started just talking about different girls, and I started asking about just, you know, what happens on the tour bus, and then the guy started saying that, but he's 19, so I felt a little bad because
it's almost like you're
I didn't want to feel like, but he said it, and there was a lot of stuff I didn't put on the record that I tried to be a little, you know, conscious of. So, but you have to have a story. You can't come away and just print like a fanzine.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah. Like a puff piece of,
well, in this Rolling Stone documentary that just came out that Alex Gibney did, it's like a two part
about the 50 year anniversary.
And Cameron Crowe, who, you know, wrote for Rolling Stone in the 70s and based Almost Famous off of that experience, he tells a story in that about going out with Led Zeppelin and spending a lot of time with them, coming back, handing in his story, and Jan Wenner called him in, who owns the magazine, still is here, and he said, "I read your story, you did a good job, but you failed." And Cameron said, "Why?" And he said, "Because you wrote this from a fan's perspective. I didn't learn anything about this if I'm not interested in them. It's not for me. And you're writing for an audience that might not care about the person. You want to put them in perspective and context." So it's funny because I saw that and then I emailed Cameron because I did this Avett Brothers story about this the folk band, the Avett Brothers. And it was a hard thing to write because I came away and I felt like I didn't have much. Like I was with them and I felt like, oh, I'm on their tour bus. That's a lot of access. I'm just, you know, hanging out with them. And then I came away afterward. I tried to write the thing and I couldn't write it. And so I tried and I handed it in and then we printed it. And then Jan called me in on my, it was my birthday. And then there was an appointment got scheduled for the next day in Jan's office. Like, what is this? And then one of the editors said, "Oh, he didn't like your Avett Brothers story." So that was not a good night. And, he had a very particular thing about how the second section, which was going into the two brothers in the band and how they have all this conflict, that was buried down in the second section. The whole first section was just kind of like them on the tour bus, very cliche. Mm-hmm. And he said, you should have put this up here. And it was a learning experience.
But once again, I have a journalism degree as well. And the thing they teach you in journalism school is what's the lead?
Yeah.
What's the lead of the story? And I remember I worked for the newspaper and they sent me to some, I don't know, swim tournament. And I came back with results and the guy's like, what is this shit? I go, well, because there's no story here. Where's the story?
Yeah.
And you have to come out of there. Like you said, I remember when I was going and doing it, like, okay, that's my lead. That's what I'll kick off with because that's the crux of the story.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and if you get stuck on it, you kind of try to picture it like a movie. Like, what's the
right?
Because movies are very similar. Documentaries, you know, you start with the conflict, and that's why people think that, you know, journalists twist things a lot because conflict is what draws people in, and it's how you do that conflict.
Yeah,
you do it in a way that you know,
known as clickbait. Now.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about Jan Wenner, because I'm always obsessed, very interested with guys like, okay, so my boss, Vince McMahon, Lorne Michaels, Jan Wenner, they've created this iconic pop culture thing that never existed before, and it's lasted now for 20, 30, 40 years, WWE, Saturday Night Live, Rolling Stone magazine. Now, I know Vince and Lorne, having worked with Lorne a bit as well, are very hands-on. Everything that goes through that thing that has the WWE on it goes through Vince. Mm-hmm. Is it the same with Jan?
I mean, he reads every story. He approves every story.
Oh, so before it gets published, he has to approve everything?
He doesn't approve the final. He'll approve the fact that the story is happening.
They'll send him Patrick to go talk to the other brothers for approve.
And if for stories he's invested in and wants to, you know, especially the political stuff, he'll read that ahead of time and be very involved in it. A lot of the music stuff, and he can't be there every step of the way for everything, but after 50 years, but he's there. He's very, very much more involved than I thought when I first came here. You know, they have these memo meetings where you come up with an idea and you have to write a little, you know, snapshot of what that story would be. And then he'll read it and give you, let's send that person to go talk to
sure, to band. Whoever. Right.
Yeah. So, and then
does he decide who goes on the cover?
Yeah. It'll get me his final.
Well, you have, okay, this month we have three options.
Yeah.
Which one do you like best?
Yeah. 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 Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Lorne Michaels because I just read that whole oral history of Saturday Night Live. And, you know, that started in the 70s. And it was just Lorne's kind of crazy vision that everyone trusted with him with. And then, you know, with Jan, it's a lot of parallels there.
That's something like with Lorne and even with Vince McMahon, too, creating this whole thing you know, this, like I said, this cultural. Make this impact of something that did not exist, but now it'll never go away. Like Rolling Stone in some way or form will be around.
I really hope so. I know we're up for sale right now.
I heard about that.
And I hope that it keeps the DNA because this Jan's the DNA of it. You know, it's weird. You know, people say it's not a music. I thought you guys were a music magazine when we put Snooki on the cover or something, which was, I don't know about that choice. Well,
but she was hot at the time.
She was hot at the time. But it's a whole world view of politics, music.
That's why I've been subscribing to Rolling Stone for 15 years now. Yeah. And I love the fact, I'm not a political guy, but the politics is very much a part of Rolling Stone.
Yes.
And pop culture and music and all that sort of thing. Do you ever write any of those type of stories? Or are you mostly a music guy?
Only when it's pertaining to music, like the West Memphis Three, those guys who were in jail, who a lot of people think they didn't murder those kids, and a lot of Eddie Vedder and a lot of people were involved in Johnny Depp and getting them out.
Metallica,
So when it's something that kind of crosses wires like that, I do, and it's not that different as far as you can. It's all storytelling, so I'd like to do more of that, but it's you kind of people. You know, there's Matt Taibbi here. You don't want to compete.
Sure,
with that.
Last few questions as we wind down here. Who's your favorite interview that you've ever had?
Oh man,
it's always hard to decide.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Or is there somebody that stood out that you weren't expecting much from that just blew you away?
I was blown away by Ed because he just seemed like a pop schmaltzy pop guy, and then you talk to him and you realize he was putting out all this music independently as a kid and trying to climb his way up, and he's like a very business savvy guy, and he doesn't like to talk about that because he thinks he sounds like an asshole when he talks about business about wanting to be the biggest person in the world. But that's someone I'm trying to think of a real the best.
You're going deep.
Yeah. A lot of my favorite experiences were early on when you're like when you don't have any clout at all and you can see who is really good, like Conan O'Brien. I grew up loving Conan, and just at Bonnaroo he was just kind of walking down this corridor and I was thinking, oh shit, I should try to get a quote from Conan, and I was afraid of ruining my perception of him by him maybe not liking being approached by somebody, and then I kind of asked him, creeped up and asked him, and then he said, oh yeah, and he started talking about returning to doing stand-up and everything, and he just was such a funny guy that there's a picture of that ran in Rolling Stone of the two of us doing that interview. So that was like the first impact that I felt at the magazine. It was that's like those little early moments. I mean, that you get like kind of jaded after a while.
You're right, right.
No, I'm sorry. My favorite is Willie Nelson.
Wow, interesting.
Because he was one of my first cover stories, and he's a difficult interview. He's very shy and doesn't like to give away a lot. He doesn't like to. He doesn't like to talk about himself. He's very into having no ego. Like one time he was doing a red carpet, and afterwards I asked him, are there any good questions? I was trying to make small talk. He said, I would have no idea what a good question is. Like he doesn't judge people in any way. You know, you might, I mean, some people might be on the red carpet and have done this a million times and be like, that's real Fozzie.
How'd your band start?
Yeah. So it was hard to get to know him, but I felt after many Texas torpedoes, as he calls them,
the giant joints.
Yeah, we started to break ice and got to the point where we could just sit there and be completely silent, which I think is a real sign that you're comfortable with somebody.
That's a great call.
I went down to Texas to his ranch, and it's his own town called Luck, Texas. He built an old Western town down there that for a movie, The Redheaded Stranger in 1986, at the end it was supposed to burn down, and he liked the town so much he had them rewrite the script, so it's still there, but it's falling apart and after hurricanes and everything. It's really, we drove around in this 1994 Chevy and like just smoked pot, and he talked about he really opened up in a way that I had never heard him open up before, and so that was the best feeling.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting too when you're with a guy like that. Like there's big stars,
yeah,
and then there's the Mix and Keith and the Nelsons. Yeah. Like that's a different level of you know, everything.
Yeah, but that he doesn't have the cowboy hat on. He has a baseball cap. He has a sweatshirt, the same sweatshirt he wears every day. And then his friend, a local businessman, came over to set up for poker that night. And they played poker till 3 a.m. And I had to go for the photo shoot the next day. And Willie looked like, you know, the photo in that spread on the, it's after he'd been out playing poker all night, and it's just, he looks so grizzled and older than he looks now. It's just a few years ago. It's the perfect
image. Exactly what you want.
Yeah, it's what you want. And so you kind of, you don't realize how special it is at the time, because they're really they seem like just people, especially someone like that.
Last question: who's your dream interview?
Well, Dylan, but he's really tough. I mean, his last interview was AARP, I think, in 2014, but he did one with Rolling Stone in 2012 with Michael Gilmore, who's done the last several. But he said some things that got him sued in that interview, and I think that these days he just does them through his own website, and I think he just writes them
what's
up.
He want? Yeah, yeah.
And but I wish that I would have the chance to talk to him. I was just interviewing Mavis Staples, who's opening for Dylan in Philadelphia, and we were in the Dylan, you know, backstage. His band was there, and I've seen Dylan like 30 times. So just even to see his guitar player, Charlie Sexton, is just, and then Tony Garnier, his bass player. Just they all. That's the best band on the road, I think. Mm-hmm. And then Mavis's road manager said, "Oh, Bob's been listening to a lot of Beach Boys lately, so he's been retooling the arrangements." And I watched the show, and you know, he did this song "Honest with Me" off of "Love and Theft," for a 2001 song, but had "Dance, Dance, Dance" from the Beach Boys in as the riff, and all the stuff that I started realizing, I couldn't believe that.
Interesting, right? Yeah.
So I did the fact that Dylan was still evolving everything, but Mavis said, "Oh yeah, he's around. He always wears the hoodie." And I guess she is allowed to go wherever she wants backstage to see Dylan. But then I walked off her tour bus. There was a guy with a hoodie, and then he turned around. It was not Dylan. I had my antenna up.
So listen, you go tap on the shoulder, turns around, it's like some guy or something.
No, it was actually.
There you go, dude. What a great time talking to you, man. I know you got a split,
Chris.
So I appreciate
Thank
it. Some great
much.
Experiences.
It's an honor Thanks, to talk dude. To you, man.
We're shaking hands. All right, thanks to Rolling Stone Magazine senior editor Patrick Doyle for sharing all the great rock and roll stories with us. You can read his interviews and articles in the magazine and, of course, online at rollingstone.com. And don't forget also, if you enjoyed this week, go and see the bonus, go listen to the bonus episode this week. Chris Jericho meets Kiss meets the Phantom of the Park with Team Tiger Awesome. We do a watch along of the movie and do a straight commentary live time as the movie's running. It was such a blast. We had a great time. It was on the Team Tiger Awesome show. I loved it so much. I brought it back to Talk is Jericho. So go check that out, and go check out all the action at Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea at ChrisJerichoCruise.com. We're selling cabins daily. There's still some left, but it's going to sell out. We only got a few months left. Book your cabin now. Come enjoy all the festivities the cruise has to offer, all inclusive for free. Everything included in the price of your cabin, all the live podcasts, concerts, comedy shows, meet and greets, autograph signings, wrestling matches, food, everything is included except for alcohol and gambling. And don't forget, like I said, the big main event, huge main event, the Alpha Club versus the Bullet Club, the Bucks of Jericho, or is it Y2 Jackson versus Kenny Omega, Cody, and Marty Scurll. It's a main event on a pay-per-view anywhere on the planet, but you can only see it if you book your cabin on Chris Jericho's Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea. Also, Impact versus Ring of Honor, Sami Callihan versus Marty Scurll, kicking that off. Live Talk is Jericho with Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. Live Talk is Jericho remembering Eddie Guerrero with Conan and Rey Mysterio. Live Talk is Jericho with the entire Bullet Club. Live Talk is Jericho with Jim Ross, Jerry the King Lawler, Mick Foley doing his 20 Years of Hell stand-up show. I'll do my own Words of Jericho live show. We got Killing the Town versus Keeping a 100 live debate. The first round of Ring of Honor, Sea of Honor tournament has been announced. Bracket A, Lethal versus Whitmer, Daniels versus Delirious, Skrull versus Titus, Young versus Flip Gordon, Bracket B, Mark Briscoe versus Ferrara, Paige versus Kazarian, Chi Battleground versus Bruce City Bruiser, and Jay Briscoe versus Kenny King. Beyond the Darkness will be there to scare your pants off. Colt Cabana, Marty DeRosa doing the Unprofessional Wrestling Show. Busted Open will be there. Live comedy from Brad Williams, Craig Gass, Run Funches, The Impractical Jokers. Live music from Corey Taylor of Slipknot and Stone Sour, Phil Campbell and the Bastard Sons, Fozzy, King, The Stir, The Dave Spivak Project, The Darlings of Rock and Roll, The Cherry Bombs, Shoot to Thrill, the world's best female AC/DC cover band, Blizzard of Ozzy, the world's best Ozzy Osbourne cover band, our special guest cruise director, SoCal Val, Noel Foley will be there. So many things to do, it's going to blow your mind.
Listen to my appearance on Jim Ross Report this week and what's going on also to hear more about it. So go join in, be a part of history. Go book your cabin now at ChrisJerichoCruise.com and don't miss out. All right. Thank you so much. Coming up this Friday, one of my oldest friends in the wrestling business, Ultimo Dragon, one of the greatest wrestlers in Japanese history and in all time, one of my favorite rivals. He will be there. He speaks English. You're going to hear it. I've known him for over 25 years. He's a great guest. So in the meantime and in between time, we'll see you on Friday. Until then, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big... Yeah!